Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Now, coming up, what's next for Iraq? We'll speak with a scholar who advised the Iraq Study Group, and she says there is no good way out. But first, Iraq is dominating confirmation hearings for Secretary of Defense nominee Robert Gates, who's answering questions from the members of the Senate Armed Services Committee today. Asked directly by Democrat Senator Carl Levin whether the U.S. is winning the war, the former CIA director replied, "No, sir." Gates didn't offer many specifics today as to how he would change U.S. policy in Iraq, but he said the current strategy is not satisfactory.
Our course over the next year or two will determine whether the American and Iraqi people and the next president of the United States will face a slowly but steadily improving situation in Iraq and in the region, or will face the very real risk and possible reality of a regional conflagration.
Peter Greer is Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. He's following the hearings. He joins us now from Washington. And Peter, first of all, very sober assessment there. What was what's the mood at the hearings?
Well, the mood at the hearings seems to be that everyone is very glad that Mr. Gates is not Donald Rumsfeld. It appears to me that he is on, if nothing else, a quick path to confirmation for his new job.
Well, the talk is that Robert Gates is the anti-Rumsfeld, but, it's hard. People say it's hard to imagine Rumsfeld telling the Senate the U.S. is losing the war, but this comes as the leaked memo from Donald Rumsfeld was revealed in the New York Times, the memo written to the White House saying that he felt that the war effort was failing, and then Donald Rumsfeld himself just released, declassified the cover page of that memo, showing that he'd actually been working on it for a while and saying these things for a while, that the effort in Iraq was not working. Was that hanging in the air at all?
To a certain extent, I think people were ignoring the past and focusing on what Mr. Gates would do in the future. And in that sense, I think he was, if anything, we're not really sure if he's going to be that much different than Mr. Rumsfeld at this point. We're just sure that he's much more deft at answering questions, to be honest. For instance, the clip you used at the beginning of this, he did say that we are not winning in Iraq. But later in the hearing, he did also associate himself with the recent comments by a high-ranking general that we're not winning, but we're also not losing. So it's not clear exactly what he did say.
Will he be independent? Is that clear? I mean, President Bush famously listened to his inner circle. They are dropping Donald Rumsfeld, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador, one of the fiercest defenders of the war in Iraq and an early hawk. Is there a sense that as his inner circle maybe drops away, the president would even listen to Gates?
Well, that's a good question. And a number of senators did ask him that, in essence. He said that all that he could say is that he would be an independent voice. He assured them that he would be an independent voice and make up his own mind about what changes there might or might need to be in Iraq policy, but he did say there's only one president of the United States. In the end, he can't force the president to do anything the president doesn't want to do.
Yeah, we know that Gates said he felt there wasn't enough planning for post-invasion Iraq. Did he say anything else today, especially with the Iraq Study Group report coming out tomorrow? Did he say anything today about what the U.S. should do now in Iraq?
Well, no, he emphasized over and over again that what he wants to do is, in essence, go to Iraq and find out what the situation is there more thoroughly from the commanders on the ground. So he used that formulation to, in essence, avoid saying anything about what he might or might not do. However, in regards to the post-war planning comment that you made, he did say something which I thought was interesting, answering a question from Senator McCain. He said, well, yes, I think many people in the administration, in hindsight, are sorry that they did not have more troops in Iraq in the immediate post-invasion period. And that's a straight formulation that you really don't hear anyone in the administration say, obviously.
Well, the hearings will go on. But has Mr. Gates been asked at all about some of the things we spoke about yesterday on this program? His past, at past hearings, asked about his involvement in Iran-Contra as former head of the CIA, asked about whether or not he, as a CIA operative, missed the decline of the Soviet Union or politicized intelligence. Any of those questions? You said they're looking forward. So have they looked back at all?
Well, I stop listening to the hearings about the 5 minutes before I came on this show, and nobody brought up any of that yet.
Yeah.
The hearing's not over yet and has some time to go, so they may well yet come up. But people, as I said, just seem to be glad that he's not Donald Rumsfeld.
Right. Senator Robert Byrd did press Robert Gates on Iran and Syria, asking him about the wisdom of attacking either country, as there are some voices in Washington, saying should happen, in particular with Iran. Again, we understand that others are asking the U.S. to talk to Iran in particular to help settle the crisis in Iraq. So what did he say in response to Senator Byrd?
Well, he in essence said that he didn't feel I'm getting the Senator Byrd comments mixed up. He also answered similar questions from Senator Graham of South Carolina. And in answer to those, which I do recall, he said that he felt that Iran truly did want a nuclear nuclear weapons capacity, and that that would be very dangerous for the region. I'm sorry, in response to Senator Byrd, basically he said that it would be very difficult to have any kind of military, U.S. military operation against Iran, but that, again, he really couldn't foresee any what the future would hold.
Peter Greer, that's why they call it news. It's up to the minute. You're just telling us now as you recollect it. Peter Greer, Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, today, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki called for a regional conference to try to stop what's being called a civil war in his country. But yesterday in Washington, another Iraqi Shiite politician, Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, holder of the largest block of Shiite seats in parliament, rejected the idea of a regional conference. So, what to do about Iraq? Tomorrow, the Congressionally Commissioned Iraq Study Group is expected to recommend drawing down some U.S. combat troops over the next year and stepping up diplomatic efforts in the region. But there are already pundits saying that some of the moderate members of the panel, Sandra Day O'Connor, for instance, may have compromised too much, may have watered down the recommendations. And further, there's early criticism that there is no solution in Iraq. The country's irreparably broken. Well, we want to spend some time today with an Iraq scholar who was an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. Dr. Phoebe Marr is a leading Iraq specialist and author of The Modern History of Iraq. Dr. Marr, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, and the Washington Post writes, the report will say troops should be withdrawn if circumstances on the ground permit it, meaning to some, maybe never. The Boston Globe's Peter Canellos writes that the message seems to be that Iraq is a foreign policy sinkhole. The Conservative Weekly Standard editorializes that for this, meaning the Iraq Study Report, we've been waiting 9 months. Is it possible that there is no solution to fix Iraq?
There's no good solution. That's what everybody assumes. You can fix Iraq or solve the problem. But I think the expectations of the American public, the expectations of the Iraqi public as well, are much too high, and understanding what we can, what anybody can achieve. For many, many years, not just since 2003, there have been no good solutions in Iraq, only less bad.
Could you pick up that this was the sense of the study group?
Oh, yes, there's no question. Anybody who deals with Iraq soon comes to understand that it's a very difficult problem, because if you go in one direction, you take one particular solution, there are going to be very high costs and risks associated with it. If you take another solution, there are also going to be high costs and risks. And so you really have to balance and understand what kind of cost you want to pay and what you're likely to get out of it. And what you're likely to get out of it is much less than the American public expects.
Pretty sobering. Well tell us, the report will come out tomorrow, but tell us, what kinds of things did they ask you? What kind of sense did you get of what they were looking for?
Very clearly in the beginning, they were looking for assessments. And that's very important. How do we understand Iraq? What's happening there? How good it is? Bad it is? What can we expect? And so the group gave them an assessment, much less rosy than most of what has come out of the administration. In fact, the main principals went to Baghdad themselves, and that was pretty sobering.
Right.
Second, they asked us for options, and the cost of the options, and negatives and positives in the options. And we started with five and narrowed down to about two. in taking into account what we thought America could do, what Iraqis were likely to do, and so on. And they, of course, the committee themselves asked a lot of people outside the study group, and so they had a wide variety of information and just about every point of view, including, I would say, more optimistic people who thought we ought to do a certain amount to save the situation, and pessimistic people who thought it was gone and we ought to get out, and everything in between. And it was up to the commission to decide, and also to see. I think the important thing about the commission is that they include Democrats, Republicans, etc., what the American public will buy.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you came out with a report in June recommending that the political process in Iraq needs to be slowed down. And that sort of seems to be the opposite from what we're hearing from the Bush administration, you know, pushing the Iraqi government. What did you mean?
There are two different time expectations, time frames here. One is the American time frame, and the other is the Iraqi time frame. And there is a wide gap between these two. Frankly, fixing anything in Iraq, getting more stability, getting the trust between and among people, trying to build an army, all of those things are going to be enormously time-consuming. And to make some progress on that, you're really talking years. You're not talking months. The time perspective of the United States, and particularly an administration, which a while ago had to run for election and has to show results here because the American public is getting tired, their expectation of achieving certain things, a viable army, an end to violence, is very short term. They're talking months here, and to be perfectly frank about it, that's not really achievable in months. And that's what's happening here. What we would like to achieve and the cost of achieving it are not in sync for the American public.
You've also said that the government and factions have to make deals on oil revenue, do something about economic development, but also bring Sunnis into the political process. And we just read recently the Washington Post reported that the State Department is considering a plan they're calling the 80% solution in Iraq. This solution seems to say give the power to the majority Shia and Kurds. The Sunnis lost power after Saddam fell, sort of tough luck. Your thoughts on that?
Now, I would not myself espouse this. I understand where it's coming from. There's a lot of exasperation, but frankly, 20% of the population is Sunni. It's not all Sunnis who are opposed to the government. There are some Sunnis in the government. They ran in the last election, and the Accord Alliance and others are in the government. But the bulk of the insurgents, ex-Baathists and army officers, whoever they are insurgency in the insurgency, are Sunnis. And getting some of those, frankly, co-opted, bringing them into the government, giving them enough so that they stop the insurgency is critical. So it's interesting to see that apparently many Americans are losing patience, you know, and this doesn't seem to be very successful. So they're coming up with the 80% solution, but frankly, that is not a solution that has been espoused, as far as I can tell yet, by the president, who's still talking about reconciliation or, you know, bringing everybody in. And that is what the assumption was on the part of the study group.
We're talking with Iraq scholar Phoebe Marr. She advised the Iraq study group. Their report is coming out tomorrow. Coming up, we want to hear how sobering all of this is for an Iraq scholar, especially one who advised early on against the invasion. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. And now back with Dr. Phoebe Marr, a leading Iraq specialist and author of The Modern History of Iraq. She was also one of the advisors to the Iraq Study Group. They released their policy recommendations tomorrow. And Dr. Marr, you said that the study group is looking forward, not back. But we want your thoughts on an op-ed in today's New York Times. It was written by journalist Tim Pritchard. You said you read it, too. He writes about when the war in Iraq went wrong. And he points to a moment before U.S. troops entered Baghdad. It's a battle in Nasiriyah. Many listeners remember this is when Jessica Lynch was captured, members of her convoy killed. And he writes, this was a Shiite city. U.S. troops expected residents to welcome them with open arms. Instead, the Shiites took up arms and killed Marines. you know, a moment long before, you know, the victory was proclaimed in Baghdad, when someone should have said, what's wrong with this picture? You know, an early warning for what the war is now. Your thoughts on that analysis?
Well, the analysis is quite interesting and quite good. But to be frank about it, some of these things were pointed out before we went to war. There were debates, there were hearings in Congress, and it isn't as though this came out of the head of Zeus. But a number of people and scholars pointed out and warned that the rosy expectations that the administration seemed to have had before it went in were not going to hold up, that they should ask certain questions. Nobody knows exactly what to expect. You just don't know. But here are a number of things, including a nationalist reaction to occupation. When people see foreign troops, no matter who they are, where they are, they generally don't like foreign troops occupying their country. Now, it's true that many Iraqis were happy to see the end of Saddam Hussein, including the Shia. But on the one hand, you could be happy to see that, but on the other hand, not happy to see foreign troops, especially in a very traditional kind of rural society, which isn't used to this kind of thing. But certainly, all of these things should have been examined, and that is a whole huge topic that the United States needs to engage in. Why did we do this? What went wrong? What are the lessons to be learned for the future? Absolutely needs to be done.
Dr. Phoebe Marr, a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and author of The Modern History of Iraq. Dr. Marr, again, I go back to the topic we spoke of at the top, you know, this idea that it's just so broken in Iraq. Do you think that what we're going to be hearing tomorrow, the subtext is that there's just going to be years of babysitting for a country that the U.S. broke?
Well, it probably won't be as blunt as that. I haven't seen the report itself, but I think it's going to take a very realistic picture of Iraq, what's happening there, and my assumption is that in terms of moving towards stability, if that's going to be the end, some kind of stability in Iraq that the U.S. can live with, I think it's quite clear that it's going to take years, that if we're going to have any involvement there, hopefully it will be more non-military than military, that fixing Iraq, stabilizing Iraq, let's put it that way, is certainly going to take years and not months. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily a huge amount of U.S. troops for a long time. But I expect the report is also going to point out what would happen if Iraq fails to stabilize, if we don't put some effort into it and we don't help the Iraqis move ahead. There's also a very big cost to the United States and the region if we have total collapse.
And what is some of the what's some of the projection with total?
Spillover to the rest of the region. All of the neighbors are worried about this. You've got a nest of al-Qaeda terrorists in Anbar, and of course that can spill across to Saudi Arabia, spill across to Syria. Saudi Arabia is where the oil is, and that could be devastating. We have the emergence of Shiite groups that are very radical, not moderate Shia groups, people like Muqtada al-Sadr, and even beyond Muqtada al-Sadr, small militias that are emerging that could radicalize the area. And you're going to get definitely going to get more Iranian influence. How much, we don't know. And one of the things we don't want to see this become is a kind of region-wide Shia-Sunni undeclared war.
Dr. Phoebe Marr, one of the advisors to the Iraq Study Group and author of The Modern History of Iraq. Dr. Marr, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, you are married to an Iraqi, we understand.
Oh, yes.
How are you depressed about this moment in history? Are you reassured that at least someone is talking about where is this for?
Let me tell you, I've worked 50 years on Iraq, off and on. I've done other things. My husband left Iraq in 1977 because he couldn't stand the boss, and he's never gone back. Now, a lot of Iraqis are deeply involved. People are deeply involved in this situation emotionally, and they are depressed. They're extremely depressed. I'm not. I think it's a very depressing situation. But if you don't sort of distance yourself as a scholar from the subject, this is going to be depressing virtually all the time.
The rest of your life.
I don't think it's a good situation, and I intellectually, I'm fascinated by it. It's compelling, absolutely compelling to see how it's going to go and where it's going to go. But if I got involved and everybody got involved emotionally, they couldn't make good judgments, and that often happens. That's one of the things that's happened. People get too committed to what they want to see, and they forget to look at what's really there. So I can't say that I'm optimistic, but you have to distance yourself somewhat. It's not a good situation. It's not going to be a stable country for at least a decade, in my view. I hope it moves in the right direction. Some areas in Iraq are moving in the right direction, but it is going to be it's going to be very difficult. And I think Americans have to realize just how difficult and how long this process is going to be, because we've created a vacuum. Totally new and inexperienced forces are emerging, and there is a huge power struggle.
Again, a sobering assessment from Dr. Phoebe Marr, author of The Modern History of Iraq and one of the many advisors to the Iraq Study Group. They release their policy recommendations tomorrow. Well, coming up today, Consumer Reports gives its report card on the health of the nation's chickens, the ones headed for your plate. If you're eating lunch, you might want to glance at that chicken salad sandwich. Is the chicken a little too pink? We have that report coming up. Also, we'll speak with elite mountain climber Ed Vester. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
Now.
Can you get two whole legs, chicken? Two whole legs.
Before you take that chicken from your local supermarket home for dinner tonight, you might want to check out the latest news from Consumer Reports. Earlier this year, researchers at Consumer Reports went out and bought 525 fresh-killed chickens from supermarkets, gourmet shops, and natural food stores in 23 states. They then tested the birds for two types of bacteria, Salmonella and Campylobacter, the leading causes of foodborne illness here in the U.S. What they found is not pretty. Jean Halloran is the food safety expert at Consumer Reports. She joins us now. Jean, this is bad news for chicken eaters, isn't it?
It is. We found that 83% of all the birds we tested harbored at least one of these two disease-causing bacteria. This is a significant worsening of the situation from the last time we tested 4 years ago. At that point, only about half of the birds had one of these two bacteria.
In fact, it went from 49% of contaminated chickens to 83%. Why do you think that is?
Well, most of it had to do with one particular bacteria, the Campylobacter.
I want to stop you right there. What is Campylobacter? I mean, and what differentiates it from Salmonella? Is it just a different kind of little organism?
It's just one of those little bugs that makes us sick, like E. coli 0157 or Salmonella. It's just one of those things that can wreak havoc with our intestines, give you terrible diarrhea. And in really bad cases, it can have some nasty side effects, including arthritis, meningitis, serious long-term problems with your nervous system.
Yeah. Well, and so you found what, that the federal government had ways of testing for Salmonella or was testing Salmonella but not Campylobacter?
Yes, the federal government has an entire program to keep Salmonella under control, where they monitor compliance, they require certain steps in the process. And even though we have more Salmonella than we'd like, the levels of Salmonella are at least staying constant from one set of tests that we do to the next. But with Campylobacter, which USDA has ignored, things have gotten seriously worse since the last time we tested. That's, in fact, gone from 40% of chickens contaminated to 80%.
And how do they chickens pick up these bacteria? I mean, we see chickens, you know, walking around. I'm assuming, you know, they pick them up in yard droppings and such?
Well, these chickens are not doing much walking around. Most of these chickens are in mass production facilities, where there are up to 30,000 chickens crammed in one on top of another. So when the chickens are in such close quarters, you have to be extremely careful about sanitation and keeping things clean. You cannot have any bacteria coming in food or in the water or around workers' feet or any other way, or it will spread like wildfire throughout the whole flock.
Well, so as horrible as life is for those poor chickens crammed into those warehouses, you're saying that one of the side effects is that these bacteria can get at them quicker because they're all crammed together like that. But didn't you also find that chickens that were free range were also, you know, had more bacteria than you thought?
Yes. We did look at no antibiotics brands, and we looked at organic brands, and they were no better in terms of the Campylobacter, and in fact, a little worse on average in terms of Salmonella.
You mentioned that you found an increase in these bacteria even in animals that weren't given antibiotics. Now, a lot of people think that chickens that are antibiotic-free are going to be better for them because then the bacteria doesn't build up a resistance to the antibiotics that's in the chickens. But you're saying that even those chickens had problems with bacteria?
We did find that there is still really broad-scale antibiotic resistance in the bacteria contaminating these chicken. 84% of the Salmonella and 67% of the Campylobacter organisms that we analyzed are resistant to antibiotics, which means it's going to be much harder to treat you. It may take a while to find a drug that treats you if you get sick from one of these things.
Just so people understand what possible end results we're talking about here, you tell the story of Leighton Kunkel, am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
A 40-year-old from Perrysville, Indiana. He was featured in an article in your magazine. What happened to him?
Right. Well, he went out one day to a restaurant and was served some chicken, which he says he realized at the time was undercooked, but he was really hungry and ate it anyway. He said from then he had severe gastrointestinal symptoms, and days later he began to lose feeling in his feet and legs. He was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a severe side effect in some cases of a Campylobacter infection, and he still has problems months later walking.
You know, you write that some companies are trying very hard. Bell & Evans, for instance, built a huge high-tech system. It's got like 2 miles of track, and these broilers are misted and chilled, submerged in an antimicrobial dip, which I'm not sure how I feel about eating, you know, chicken after that. But they really are trying to do things, and yet they can't knock out Campylobacter?
Yes, unfortunately. In our tests, we bought 28 samples of Bell & Evans, and 5 still had Salmonella, and 19 still had Campylobacter. So they have not completely solved their problems. They certainly get credit for trying, but it does show that this is a somewhat difficult problem.
Well, and the moral of that story is, it sounds like the best advice you can give to consumers as well to protect themselves from illness, if in fact 83% of chickens are contaminated, what can consumers do to make sure when they're eating at home that they can protect themselves?
You should start from the assumption that your chicken is contaminated. Your precautions have to start when you buy the chicken, and you want to make sure that it doesn't drip onto anything else, either while you're bringing your groceries home or when you put it in the refrigerator. Make sure it's wrapped well or in another container. Then when you are going to eat it, you need to take it out, and after you've finished cutting it, you need to take the knife and the cutting board and immediately wash them and wash your hands as well. Finally, you have to be sure that you cook it really thoroughly. No red drippings. It has to be cooked well done all the way through.
No pink in the middle.
No pink in the middle. And if you're in a restaurant and you detect some chicken that's got a little pink in the middle, send it back. Have them put it back under the broiler again.
Jean Halloran, food safety expert at Consumer Reports. Jean, I don't know if you even eat chicken, but if you do, are you looking at it in a different way? I mean, were you, at Consumer Reports, surprised by this, and has it changed your thinking about eating?
Well, the first time I worked on this issue 4 years ago was when I got religion about the cutting boards and knives and washing my hands. It has changed the way I look at it. I still eat chicken. The good news is that you can solve the problem by cooking the chicken thoroughly and being careful with it. But you need to really be aware.
Jean Halloran, the food safety expert at Consumer Reports. For more information on contaminated chicken and how to avoid it, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, Well, still to come on the program, and speaking of taking risks, 14 mountains and climbing, the art and danger of getting to ultra-high places with climber Ed Beesters. You're listening to Here and Now. But staying for now with food, today New York City became the first in the nation to ban trans fats in restaurant food. Trans fats are normally found in partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. It's been linked to heart disease by raising a person's bad cholesterol and lowering the good cholesterol. But New York is the city of black and white cookies, delis. What will this ban mean? We decided to call up some restaurant owners. Suzanne Levinson owns Pomfrit on the Lower East Side. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we welcome back Michael LaMonaco, chef of Porterhouse in the Time Warner Center in Midtown. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Great to hear your voice.
And well, nice to speak with you. And Suzanne, I'm hearing Pomfrit. I'm thinking something's getting fried there. These are Belgian fries, right?
They are.
But do you use trans fat oils?
We don't. We've been using sort of this 0.0% trans fat for a couple of years now.
Trans fats, we understand, are the hydrogenation of oils, the removal of essential fatty acids. I mean, it's the reason they do it is to make the shelf life longer. But now a lot of people thought it made the food better. So was this a hard decision for you to go to zero?
No, absolutely not. You know, I started this business 10 years ago thinking, oh, the innocence of serving Pomfrit like you find on the streets of Europe. A couple of years into the business, there was sort of this warning on the hydrogenated fats that you find in your cooking oil, so we turned to 0.0% at that point.
Well, now, how do you feel about the ban?
I'm an advocate of it. The more that we can educate the consumer to understand what they're eating, the better. The only thing I'm worried about is that it could have an adverse effect where people say, now it's okay to eat these foods.
Yeah.
I know what I serve at Pomfrit. It's a decadent treat. But there's still a lot of fat involved in it.
No kidding. We hear something on your menu, a French-Canadian dish made from a combination of French fries, chicken gravy, and curd cheddar cheese.
Yeah.
Michael, you serve steak and French fries. Do you use trans fats?
No, I've never used trans fats. I've always really avoided them. And canola oil has been the thing that I've used for years now.
What kinds of places might still be using trans fats?
Of course, the big chain fast food restaurants, but then also there are the smaller mom-and-pop kind of ethnic restaurants. It's inexpensive. It has a longer shelf life for the products that they use it in, and as well as a longer use life when it's used in a fryer. You know, most of the trans fats, 40% of trans fats or something like that, 40, 45%, wind up in bakery goods.
Right.
So that's really going to be something to watch.
Cakes, right.
Cookies, things like that. As you mentioned, black and white cookies.
Oh, black and whites. Do we love them or what?
Yeah.
Immortalized by the Seinfeld show where they ate black and whites. But Suzanne, you know, probably if you're wandering the streets of New York and you're going to buy from a vendor who's got a big sizzling pot of fat frying and he's dipping something in it, you know, you probably know that's not going to be the best for your heart anyway. But is there a way to taste trans fat?
You know, I'll tell you, when we changed our cooking oil, there's virtually no difference in the taste, I have found, with Pomfrit.
I agree with
that. We haven't lost any customers, right. At the same time, I don't want to promote, hey, we don't use trans fats in our oil, because, first of all, by the way, they can list on their cooking oils that it's 0% trans fat, but there's still trans fat in it. It needs to be under 0.05%. So I don't want to be deceptive and tell people, hey, you know, this is a better product to eat. There's sort of this thin line about what's going on with this.
It's definitely a tricky one, but we also want to point out, and Michael, Suzanne's made the admission that, you know, she knows that her food may be delicious, but it's not going to be the one you eat if you're trying to lower your cholesterol.
No.
You may not use trans fats, but you still use lard, animal fat.
I have a chicken pot pie once a week, and the question was, what are we going to use? You know, we're not going to use this white, creamy, hydrogenated product. Since we're making this once a week, it's really a treat. It's not something people are going to eat every day. You know, let's go to the classic crust, which is a leaf lard crust. But I don't expect to see the same person in here every day. The balanced diet is what I think Suzanne is talking about.
The bottom line seems to be, you know, sometimes a pie needs a little lard and you just can't eat too much of it.
Can't beat that crust.
That's right.
That old-fashioned pie dough.
Michael LaMonaco, chef of Porterhouse in the Time Warner Center in Midtown, and Suzanne Levinson, owner of Pomfrit on the Lower East Side, on today's New York City ban of artificial trans fats in restaurant food. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. There are 14 mountains in the world that are over 8,000 meters high. They are the world's tallest peaks. There are only 12 people in the world who've climbed them all, and a handful who've climbed them without supplemental oxygen. Well, Ed Viesters is one of those people, and he was the first American to do so. Well, now with the help of fellow climber Dave Roberts, he writes about the experience in a new book, No Shortcuts to the Top, Climbing the World's 14 Highest Peaks. And he also reveals what, along the way, he learned about the perils of corporate sponsorship and questions one has to consider when going from an individual sport, climbing, to a team sport, having a family. And Ed Viesters joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
I have to cut right to the chase because a compelling read, and yet I don't think I've ever read a sport book, in essence, that is so much about death. I mean, you know, the bodies that you're nodding yes, you're nodding as if you've heard this.
Well, I understand it. I mean, and I look at what I've experienced in my life and this game we play or this sport we're involved in, and I've lost friends and partners, and they died climbing as I was. If you rationalize it and think about it, you go, why would you want to do that? And, you know, I chose to do it a long time ago. I liked the challenge. And then I also felt that maybe I could do it differently. Maybe I could somehow, by being more thoughtful, more careful, more conservative, be safer. My goal was to come home, not to just go to the top.
In fact, what's your motto?
Well, getting to the summit is optional and getting down is mandatory. You know, getting to the summit is half the climb. And a lot of people lose sight of the fact that you still have to come down. You know, they get to the top, they think it's all over, yahoo, but the descent is more important, in fact.
And reading through, you put in a very unsentimental way a lot of your observations about climbs, in particular where you saw people perish or heard about people who had perished on other climbs. And in a very sort of straightforward way, you write about what you might have done differently. Now, some would see that and wince and say, oh, is he being critical of climbers that in other places you've professed to love, but then here you are, you know, critiquing them maybe.
I'm not sure if I was critical. I would just, people often ask me to justify what I was doing, and that's my way of justifying it. Not to say that I was Teflon-coated and was immune to the dangers, but most of the accidents and most of the deaths that occur in the mountains are self-inflicted by making bad judgments or by pushing harder and further and longer than is reasonable. So in my way of looking at it, that's simply a way for me to justify what I continue to do and why I continue to do it.
Well, also maybe to learn from it. You've climbed Everest. How many times have you climbed?
6 times to the summit.
Yeah. Listeners know you were featured in David Brashear's IMAX film about the mountain, which was, of course, shot in May of 1996, mm-hmm. which I don't know if your heart flops when you hear that date.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's something probably I think about or talk about almost every day.
This is when a snowstorm claimed the lives of 8 climbers, 2 of them friends of yours. In particular, Rob Hall, and this was just excruciating to read because he lived for a day on the mountain. And what was your role with him?
He was trapped at 28,700 feet. He somehow survived one night sitting out there in the storm. And the next morning, it was around 5 in the morning, the radio crackled to life, and it was Rob. Since I was one of his closest friends, I got on the radio, and intermittently, for about 6 hours, I talked to him. And I think my job, or people were hoping that I could maybe get him excited enough or even to yell at him to get him up and moving to start working his way down the mountain. And I also told him jokes, anything that I could kind of liven up the day a little bit. And in the meantime, several times during that, you know, we connected his wife to him via satellite telephone. Ugh. And we would overhear those conversations and we would be in tears listening to that. And then I'd have to get back on the radio with this really, you know, strong front and say, come on, Rob, get moving.
Yeah, and yet it didn't work.
No, he couldn't move. He was frostbitten. He was debilitated by the cold and lack of oxygen. And the second night, he simply, you know, went to sleep and never woke up again. And I think we all knew that's what was going to happen. And I think he himself, you know, he was a smart guy. He knew as well. And you know, I think about that. Imagine sitting somewhere contemplating your death and knowing that tonight when you fall asleep, you won't wake up again.
Yeah, and knowing that you have a wife at home. And that's what surprises me at Viewster, because in reading the book and reading that you co-authored it with David Roberts. Now, David Roberts has been on this program several times. He's recently written a book, which was, I guess, pretty controversial. We heard from a lot of climbers. Coming to the conclusion that climbing is unfair to families. He realized that it put his loved ones in a terrible position, and he wasn't willing to do that anymore. You write in your book about getting married, having kids. I thought you were going to come to that same conclusion. I thought you're shaking your head no.
No. Again, I think, like I said, the reason that I justified what I was doing was how I was doing it. And when I met my wife, she never asked me to stop climbing. She knew this is what I was. This is the guy she fell in love with. And even when I had children, I might have become more conservative.
Well, in fact, you say that. You say that you did.
And that's fine. And I'm so glad that I'm sitting here today because of that. There are situations where there's nothing you can do about it. You know, a random occurrence that you cannot manage. But I truly believe that a lot of the problems that occur are because of bad decision-making in the mountains.
Well, as interesting as the many times you climbed are the times you didn't, that you turned back and just said, oh, no. And that's hard to see, too. I mean, months of preparation, months, you know, on location, getting to a certain point. You're on the mountain. You're just not at the summit, and we're going back.
Yeah, and the conditions were saying, listen, it's not good for you to go on. And what I have termed it as I was listening to the mountain. And when my instincts were telling me something was wrong, it was wrong. And I would just simply stop and walk away.
There's one story that you tell, and this was when you were a guide on Mount Rainier. And this is not this is what some people would say is just kind of, you know, an easier thing to climb. And there's a guy who walks past you. Tell the story, because it was remarkable. He walks past you one day.
We were guiding on Mount Rainier. This was 10 years ago, and we had had very warm weather, even above 14,000 feet, and it had rained, and then everything froze. So the whole mountain became this literal sheet of ice, and we had taken our clients to a point at about 13,000 feet, and we decided it was unsafe to continue with our guided group. So
what's the summit there?
14,000 feet.
Uh-huh.
And as we were there making this decision to turn around, a solo climber passed me, and I mentioned to him, you know, be very careful. It's extremely dangerous. And as he passed me, he simply said, it's only Mount Rainier. Hmm. 10 minutes later, as he had climbed above me, he slipped and fell and slid very quickly down the slope. Unable to stop himself, he came flying past me and literally took me out as he flew past.
Sitting up, looking down the hill with a look of horror on his face.
With a look of horror. And I'll remember that look of horror on his face for as long as I live. And he continued down the mountain for several thousand feet and ended up dead in a crevasse. And I remember we climbed down to make sure, to see perhaps he was still alive. Was there anything we could do? And as I looked at him and I thought, you know, it's only Mount Rainier. You know, mountains are mountains, whether they're 14,000 feet or 29,000 feet. And there's something that Lou Whitaker, one of my mentors, says, you know, just because you love the mountains doesn't mean they love you.
Hmm. Ed Viesters, the name of his book is No Shortcuts to the Top, Climbing the World's 14 Highest Peaks. It was written with climber David Roberts. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And continued success to you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.